little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
This is a show called Thinking Clearly, a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelick. I'm one of the co-hosts of Thinking Clearly, and my voice is coming in remotely on a Skype connection as we shelter in place in the midst of this current COVID-19 pandemic. And with me, remotely also.
Hey, it's Julia, and I'm on Skype, Skyping in from my home to wherever you are.
Co-host Julia Minton, why don't you tell folks, as we usually do, how they can get in touch with us and get all of our archive shows in podcast versions?
Absolutely. So, as I like to say, Bob and I are real people, and we love to hear from you, our listening audience. In fact, so many of our shows have been based off of the feedback that we've gotten from you, our listeners. If you'd like to engage with us, know about future shows, you can check out our Facebook page. And we're also podcasting. Not only are we doing this show live pretty quickly the next day, we have a podcast that comes out. You can find that really, if you have a podcast app, just open up your podcast app and search for a new podcast feed. Put in Thinking Clearly, we should come up. You can also find us at thinkingclearly.libsyn.com. And that has the entire archive of our Thinking Clearly shows.
Yeah, and I want to encourage people to go to our Facebook page, too, because we put a lot of extra bonus content on there. We give links to some of the information that we talk about on the show. So what are we going to talk about tonight, Julia?
Well, we're going to talk about what everyone else is talking about.
What might that be?
The COVID-19 pandemic. I mean, if there weren't a better time to apply our critical thinking skills than now, I don't know what else there would be.
That's the topic for tonight. And a reminder at the start that we're going to open the phone lines for listeners with questions or comments on the topic, on tonight's topic. Well, let's start out with a review of what critical thinking is. And we have a kind of a precise definition and description of critical thinking that we've been working on over the years. It's gotten rather lengthy. So I'm not going to read the definition as I sometimes do, but just kind of summarize the high points of it. Starting out with, we're faced with an issue of some sort. Someone talks to us about a topic, has a claim that's related to some particular issue. And we hear that or we see it on social media and we decide, you know, that's something that I'm not so sure about. I want to know more about it and I want to think about it critically. So that's the first step, is to do some background research to adequately understand the issue, because we don't know as much about anything in this world as we really think we do until we start getting into the details. And when we get into the details, we find there's key words in there that we really don't quite understand. And so the first part is to surround that issue with your understanding so that you really know what the ins and outs of that issue are. And then what do you do after that, Julie? Do anything besides that?
Well, I mean, I'm kind of stuck on that because I'm pretty sure I already knew everything. So I didn't know that there was more background research that needed to get done.
Well, there is, because you just understand the issue now, right? But then you got to go out and robustly research. I love that word robust because it really applies. It means not just cherry picking and going out and picking out the things that we kind of agree with already, but to actually look at both evidence that relates both pro and con to the claims that are made by that issue. Can you describe what we mean when we use that term claims?
Well, sure. A claim is much like, I think we've talked about premises before, a little bit different. A claim is the hypothesis in a sense. No?
It's something that related to some particular issue is expressed as a fact, which is true or false. It's a purported statement of fact that can be true or false. And so most issues, when you listen to them, no matter what they are, have claims with them, because that's what the person really wants to express, is this fact that they know or think they know about a particular issue. So you can pick those claims out because they just stand out like a sore thumb. They're standing there as statements of fact, and sometimes they're supported by references, or you can go and look that up to see if that claim actually is true or not or has some support. But often they aren't. These claims are just made as statements, but given no support, no places to look for more information about it. So this is the second thing you do. You understand an issue, and then you look for the pros and cons. You identify the claims in the issue, and then you look for evidence, both pro and con, that support the claim or maybe deny the claim.
Claim might be Thinking Clearly is the best radio show.
Exactly. And there's another step now. After you understand the issue and you look for evidence to support the issue, how do you use that evidence? What's it called?
Well, are we talking about how you would construct the argument that you would take?
Yes.
You take the background research that you've done and
yes,
the evidence that you've evaluated leading towards this claim, and you construct a logical argument based on that evidence that supports your claim. So
yeah,
I went and I listened to all the radio shows and I evaluated the evidence. I gave them grades A to F. And I still think Thinking Clearly is the best radio show.
Yeah. And that's a good start, right? Then you could go out and create a survey and survey the listening audience and see what they think. So there's all kinds of nuances, details that go along with being a critical thinker. And I want to say, it is a lot of work. It's not simply reading something on social media and passing that on. It's not simply taking an idea that somebody's expressed that you really agree with, but really haven't thought through or analyzed critically, and going a thumbs up or a thumbs down on that, you know. So it does take work, and you have to pick and choose, right? You can't think critically about everything, or that's all we'd ever do.
Yeah, and I would also add that sometimes the critical thinking takes place incrementally. As we are, as we approach new evidence, we may dig into that and say, well, where did that evidence come from? You know, is it a reliable source? So it's not always, you know, sometimes it can be a big research project, but also critical thinking can be an application in how we keep our information accurate and up to date, don't you think?
Definitely. You know, sometimes I'll see something on social media and I go, I really want to check that out. And I'll start researching it, and I almost always find that the issue is much more complex than the headline. And sometimes I'll go through actually searching out the evidence, even constructing an argument, and then find out, you know, I still need to know more before I get on and give this argument, because I want my argument to be sound. I want it to be my logic to be valid. I want it to hook to premises or claims that are evaluated as best I can as being true. Let's kind of transition from, in general, what critical thinking is to this whole thing that we're living through. And it's the first time in any of our lifetimes that we've experienced something of this scope that was such a health crisis worldwide that it's called a pandemic. So I did a little research and a little searching on the internet, and I came across an article that I really liked. It was written about the work of Dr. Amanda Hughes from Brigham Young University, and she studies the functioning of social media during disasters and crises. What an interesting area of study. And I was able to pre-record an interview with her on the spread of information and misinformation and disinformation during this COVID-19 pandemic. So you want to take a listen to this interview. This is Bob Frelick on a recorded Skype call on April 21st, 2020. And I'm with Professor Amanda Hughes from the School of Technology at Brigham Young University to talk about the importance of using critical thinking skills during this current COVID-19 global pandemic that we're all experiencing. Professor Hughes, thanks for taking the time for this.
You're welcome.
Glad to get an opportunity to talk with you, because I understand that you've spent a lot of your career studying social media during disasters and crises. How did you get into that very interesting sounding area of study?
Well, it was very serendipitous in many ways, in that I was working with someone as my advisor while I was doing my PhD at the University of Colorado in Boulder. And she got a grant to study social media and disaster and crisis. And this happened just after Hurricane Katrina. All interest was kind of starting to focus in on how can we alleviate like all the problems and things that happened during these big, massive crisis events. And social media was really new at the time. So there was a lot of interest in how could this new medium be helpful. And it was interesting because a lot of it wasn't very helpful at first. People had a long time, it was a long time before people kind of accepted social media as a as an acceptable place to share and find information. But that certainly changed over time.
And did you notice right from the start the amount of misinformation and disinformation that's sometimes prevalent?
Not right away, because at first people were using it in kind of more altruistic ways. And I think they still do. It's still used in many good ways. But I think it wasn't until social media became more mainstream that people started to kind of weaponize it, as you might say, to come up with ideas or spread misinformation or disinformation to kind of rile people up and get them excited about things. We didn't see a lot of it until probably about 5 years after we kind of started studying it. And then we started seeing it more and more. And certainly we're seeing it a lot more these days.
That's very interesting. I didn't really realize that. And a whole conversation around how the disinformation and misinformation started and spread would be really interesting. But for this interview, I'd really like to focus on information related to the current COVID-19 pandemic. What tools and techniques do you use to examine that information and assess its accuracy?
So part of this is that when I study it, we usually collect as much information as we can, and then we go off and study it after the fact when we have a lot more time to do so. This event has kind of been different because it's been so prolonged. Most disaster events happen, and then, you know, it may be a week or maybe a month, and then it's done, and then we kind of move on, and then we have, you know, and then we'll go and study it for months afterwards, where we will carefully kind of reconstruct what happened, look at the timeline and what information was available at what particular time. So this event is a little different in that it's still happening and has been happening for quite some time, and there's no immediate end in sight. And so it's still very much this evolving situation where we're kind of scrambling to try to figure out what's going on, but not being able to do it perhaps in as systematic a way as we would like to, because that usually takes a lot more time than we currently have to be able to talk about what's happening currently. A lot of it is a little more anecdotal at the moment because we haven't had enough time to really study it and really dig in and get all the data.
Do you actually use some kind of programming or bots or something to monitor that, or is it just people actually listening in?
So some of it's a little bit of both. We do have lots of, you know, I have a lot of students that are programmers, and we build tools where we listen to, like, Twitter, for example. All the social media sites tend to have their own API. It's an application programmer interface. It basically is a way that you can connect to them and get information in large quantities kind of more automatically rather than like physically visiting each page and looking at it. So then it allows you to kind of like get a big dump of all the Twitter messages that are talking about the coronavirus. So we do that kind of stuff, but we also have a lot of digital volunteer work that we do where we have humans look at messages and try to decide whether they're relevant and whether they could be useful for different emergency responders. And that's more of a manual type of task. But when we do that, what we're doing is we're trying to have humans label the data so that we can then train machine learning algorithms to try to mimic that behavior, to try to do it automatically, because there's just so much data out there that you can't have a human look at it, look at everything.
And that cooperation between artificial intelligence and human beings is a whole other interesting topic that I'd love to spend time on. Getting back to COVID, though, what's your perspective on why it's especially important to get information during this crisis?
it's important during any event, really, to get good information. But I think particularly why it's important during this event is just understanding what it means for you, because everybody is affected by this event, which is another thing that is very interesting about this event and different from other events that we've looked at, is that the whole world is affected in some sort of way. They're being asked to take measures that they wouldn't normally take to be able to prevent the spread of the virus. And so everybody's wondering, how does this affect me? How does this affect me in terms of what I need to do personally? How does it affect my health? How does it affect me economically in terms of my job or whether I'll have a job? And so I think there's so much important information out there. And I think there's a lot of misinformation about what to do, what kinds of measures that you should take, but also misinformation about what is going to happen. And that kind of tends to, I think, get people excited and a little worried about the future, about what that holds, and perhaps taking actions that maybe are a little more emotional than critically thought out.
And we're using terms misinformation and disinformation, and I know most of our listeners are probably aware of the difference between the two. Can you give a quick contrast between misinformation and disinformation?
Yeah, so I'll say how I define them in my head, because sometimes I think everybody sometimes has a slightly different version of that. But in my head, misinformation is information that is spread, but usually not in a malicious way. Not necessarily where the sender is intending to sow discord, where disinformation is definitely where someone's purposely injecting information, trying to get people to believe or act in a particular type of way, where I think misinformation is a little less purposely harmful. At least that's the distinction in my mind, is kind of the difference between the two, as being one is more purposeful in the intent where people are trying to get people to do something that they wouldn't necessarily normally do.
Very good. I saw a recent article in TechCrunch that was reporting on information and misinformation and disinformation. And TechCrunch had obtained from a company called Yonder, which apparently is an artificial intelligence company that monitors online conversations, including disinformation. And the quote from TechCrunch was as follows. It said, conspiracies that would normally remain in fringe groups are traveling to the mainstream in faster times during this epidemic. Is that consistent with what you've been finding?
Definitely. I've definitely seen that a lot. And I think a lot of it has to do with people being so anxious about what's happening and constantly looking for new and different information, and everybody kind of being in this stasis where we're all just sitting around kind of wondering what's going to happen next. And we're looking online because many of us are trapped at home. I say trapped, but we're at home, and that's all we perhaps have access to be able to get information, is we're looking online and trying to find the next thing. And I think it makes it easier for people in these kind of anxious times to latch on to information that resonates with them in some way. And maybe it's not in a good way necessarily, because I find a lot of that information tries to get you excited. And that's why they want you to kind of get angry or upset and to spread that information.
I was hoping that you'd give a little counterpoint to that quote, because I've been seeing folks having less tolerance for misinformation and actually calling their friends out on Facebook for reposting bad information. And I was hoping that that would become the trend.
I've seen a lot of that too. And so this is where it's hard for me to say exactly how often things are happening, because a lot of this is just anecdotal from what I'm seeing in my own social media circles. But I have seen a lot of information about people trying to share good information and trying to help other people think a little more carefully about what information they share. I know there's a lot of efforts by social media platforms to try to get people to think a little more carefully about what they're sharing. You know, I don't know how successful they've been necessarily, but I think those efforts are in a good place, because I think we do need to think more carefully about what we share.
that's kind of a recurrent message on our show, Thinking Clearly, is that it's important anytime to be a critical thinker and to check out information sources and that kind of thing. Any other kinds of misinformation or disinformation that you're actually seeing?
I think probably the stuff that I'm seeing the most is politically based, where people are trying to kind of position themselves to look better against other political parties and trying to make decisions that favor them or make other people look bad. And I mean, that certainly has been happening since political parties have been around, but I feel like there's certainly a big push for that. And it probably has something to do with it being an election year too. But I think there's a lot of misinformation that's being circulated from politicians that are trying to please or make other people look bad, and they're trying to do it through the information that they share. And sometimes I don't know that they are as accurate as they could be.
Yeah, you're talking about selecting certain information and then framing that in a way that fosters their own ideology or political point of view, right?
Exactly. Like, I think we've seen most people have probably seen just instances where people have said that something was a successful way to treat COVID, and then many people trying to find homemade ways of using that particular method to treat it, and then having real problems because it's not a medical, it's not medically supervised or approved.
In an article about your work that I read that prompted me to seek you out for this interview, it appeared in, I think, the Brigham Young University Communication News article, and then was picked up by a number of other publications. You suggested a number of things that we can all do to find relevant and trustworthy information online during these uncertain times. Could you go over that a bit for our listeners?
Yes, definitely. So I kind of had three different tips that I talked about, and one was looking for solid information sources. So looking for people who it's kind of their job to know or to be on top of what is happening at the current time. So I think for me anyway, local sources like local county and county health departments who are monitoring the situation in my area, certainly other types of organizations that are responsible for monitoring epidemics, things like the CDC, and sometimes it's also just about you finding what is a good source for you and what do you trust, and kind of sticking with those sources and not necessarily going out and just wandering around looking for new sources, because I think that's sometimes where people get overwhelmed and find that there's just too much information out there. So finding some sources that you find are reliable and kind of sticking with those.
That's great. Well, do you have any other closing thoughts for us relating to what you've been discussing?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a couple other things, too, about being skeptical about the messages that you're seeing, especially messages that get you upset or emotional, angry, you know, feeling excited like you have to pass this on right away. That's kind of a sign that maybe you should step back and think about, is this something that needs to be passed on? Maybe I should fact check it a little bit to make sure that it's correct before I send it on. I think that's probably one of my key things, is whenever I feel like I'm getting emotional about this message, it's a signal to me to think whether this is something that I should be passing on or whether it's just something designed to kind of get me upset so that I will pass on this information that may not be correct.
Okay. Anything else before we wrap it up?
Yeah, I think that's it.
Professor Amanda Hughes from Brigham Young University, thank you very much for taking the time to share your thoughts and experiences with our Thinking Clearly listeners. On our Facebook page, Amanda, we're going to link to the article about you that I mentioned. Are there any other links that you wish to share?
I don't think so, not at this time.
Okay, so thank you very much, and keep healthy there in Utah.
I will. Thank you.
Well, Julia, did that interview trigger any thoughts for you?
You know, the first thing I have to say is I will publicly acknowledge my bias that there would be a critical thinking scholar at Brigham Young University. There, I said it.
I would really love to have her back as a guest for an hour on some future show.
And, absolutely.
Yeah, because she's been studying social media for a good long time, and I would be interested in the details from her as to how social media has changed over that time.
Yeah, absolutely. But you also, you know what I mean about Brigham Young is very well known for being a religious institution, especially in a newer religion of the Church of the Latter-day Saints, also known as Mormons. And, you know, no judgment there, but just not a school of thought that I typically associate with logic and critical thinking and fact-finding and stuff like that. So this was an opportunity for me to expand my understanding and to acknowledge some of the prejudice I have in this world.
Let's transition a little bit now back into a couple different situations, one being where we were before this pandemic, before this health crisis that has absorbed us so much and changed our lives in so many ways. We've made the case a long time, ever since we started this show, as to how important and why it's important in these modern times, pre-crisis times, to use critical thinking. And we've talked quite a bit about the extreme polarization between groups, between parties, between various groups that people affiliate with, and that polarization causes a breakdown of communication and a devaluation of each other. It's us versus them. And it undermines social cohesion. It erodes cooperation between these polarized groups. And we've talked quite a bit about how that is unhealthy for a democracy. And we've talked quite a bit about the internet and social media. You're into social media. That's a big part of your life. And so you know the amount of misinformation, disinformation that just spreads at like firestorm rates. It goes viral, allowing information to really become weapons of mass deception. That's the phrase I like to use.
I'll just interject. Line of thought, you know, one of the things that social media does, in particular Facebook, not so much Twitter, is that it brings people of similar thinking together and reduces information that you normally wouldn't agree with. So it actually kind of is encouraging what we've called, what we've talked about in the past as sort of tribalism, or the divisiveness that normally exists becomes magnified on Facebook and YouTube.
Talk a little bit about how the business model for monetizing internet services factors into this.
Yeah, well, one of the things that really stood out to me from that interview was how she said whenever she has an emotional reaction, she kind of takes pause and looks into that a little bit more. Because so when it comes to internet monetization, it's the clicks. The clicks are like money, cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching. And because of advertisers. And to get you to click on one article versus another, or one video versus another, often comes back to the sort of emotion that the title can evoke out of you. And, you know, you might read some, you know, extreme article title and you go, oh my God, could that be true? And you click on it and it turns out it's much more nuanced. It's probably something you never would have clicked on to begin with if it wasn't for that emotional reaction that you have wanting to know more. And, you know, this whole pandemic situation is certainly a climate that begets a lot of fear. You know, and rightly so. I mean, it's a fearful time, but that really can, again, amplify our emotional reactions to some of the information that we come across.
Yeah. Makes me think of is like slot machines in a gambling casino, is that the house knows that the more you play those machines, you're going to win sometimes and sometimes you're going to lose, but you're inevitably over the long run going to lose money, and they're going to make money. And that's what the social media companies, especially Facebook, for example, that's what they bet on. Because sometimes I see people putting on social media things they want to make fun of, things that they don't believe. and they put it on social media and then make some sarcastic remark about how stupid people are to believe this. Well, what does that do? That causes some people, even though they may not agree with it and think and agree that it is stupid, it's going to cause them to click on that just to see what it's about. And when they click on it, that's the ka-ching for the company because they do their ads on there. So it's kind of a win-win situation for social media, and it's turning out to be sometimes we win on social media. It's good in some ways. It can be really, really helpful, but it's the companies that are using it and getting into this whole clickbait, get us riled up, appeal to our emotions. They're winning a lot more than we are on it, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would bring up YouTube in particular, because when you watch a video that's of interest to you, if it were to then recommend another video that is of a different topic or of a different point of view, you're not as likely to watch the next video. And what ends up happening is you end up down kind of like a rabbit hole of getting into more and more specific and sort of radical videos being recommended towards you. One of the things I really like to point out is that, you know, social media is not static. It's not a newspaper that's printed. And when you open it, we all read page two. We all read the same page two. That's not at all what's happening on most of the internet, and in particular, social media and YouTube. That what you're seeing is very specifically catered to you based on your previous engagement history.
Let's talk now about why critical thinking is especially important during this pandemic and during this time of crisis that we're all in. One thing that comes to my mind is that this is a global crisis. That's why they call it pandemic. Everyone in the world is being affected in one way or another by this virus that we're subject to. So it becomes very important to have cooperation between different people in different locations, not only different states and counties in our country, but throughout the world. In that case, misinformation can really be life-threatening. So that's one of the things that comes to mind. Do you have any ideas about this as to why it's extra specially important during this pandemic to engage in critical thinking?
Yeah, one thing that particularly comes to mind is, you know, you refer to it as a virus, but the thing that makes it, you know, we have viruses all around us most of the time. The thing that makes this different is it's a novel virus. It's new. It's not, you know, like influenza that we've become acclimated to. And because it's new, there's not a lot of information. We're dealing with a lot of uncertainty, a lot of inexperience, and a lot of figuring this out as we go along. And that also lends itself to fear and anxiety. But I also think that that level of uncertainty is happening so much of the time that, you know, it would make us kind of crazy to have to deal with this level of unknowns on a day in and day out basis. So I think that's definitely part of the reason that critical thinking is so crucial, is that what we are learning about COVID-19 is a moving target, and information is going to continue to change. And the way that we respond to the changing information, the way we respond to this pandemic is also going to continue to change as we learn new things. So this is really kind of science in action.
Another part of this is that it's important, you know, that the directives and the policies that are implemented to address the crisis are evidence-based. We're seeing science in action as we collect data, and the data shows us how our approach to this virus needs to be changing. We're seeing this on a sort of updated, on a daily basis, sometimes an hourly basis. So it's kind of a preview of how we could constructively use information and data in the future to our advantage. So we also want our policymakers to be critical thinkers. It's important that they're using evidence-based policies. Now, you have to combine evidence-based policy and science with what people's values are. Because if you implement, even though some science-based policies might be the best thing to do overall, you have to take into consideration whether people are going to reject those ideas on the basis of their values. And so it's kind of a dance between those two, don't you think?
Yeah, well, having buy-in from citizens in any sort of major political changes is certainly crucial for those to be successful changes. Boy, I couldn't agree more that we need politicians more than ever to be making policy decisions based on evidence and understanding and accepting that that evidence may continue to change. The politician needs to, yes, represent and reflect the citizens and their intent, but the politician can also be incredibly helpful in helping citizens understand these complex issues and why policy decisions are made the way that they are. I see it as a two-way street.
Let's just summarize. Let me just summarize the what we've been talking about here as to why it's important in this time of COVID-19 crisis. This is a recent piece I read by Marquette University website professor. Well, it was on the website, Professor Kyle Whitaker, and he wrote this, quote, "Misinformation and disinformation are dangerous enough when we're not in the throes of a pandemic. They're literally life-threatening when we are. Most of us aren't epidemiologists, so we have to take the word of others for what to believe about the novel coronavirus and COVID-19 and the respiratory disease that it causes. And information about it abounds. This information comes from in several forms, including false remedies, conspiracy theories, memes that downplay or politicize the threat or trivialize it by comparing it to well-known treatable diseases, and conflicting testimony from authority figures. These forms of misinformation all have serious consequences, and they can fool even those who are in a position to know better." I thought that was kind of a good summary.
Yeah, that's really spot on. And I appreciated that in your interview that you guys did talk about misinformation and disinformation because they're both factors. I think most of us, you know, have indulged in misinformation innocently. You know, it's we didn't know any better, or you know, it was confirmation bias, something agreed with the thoughts that we already had. But there is also, especially in times of such difficult times as this, that there are those who want to sow chaos and perpetuate, you know, those are the actors in disinformation who are actively trying to spread false information for usually nefarious purposes.
Well said. It's really important, and I feel very strongly about this. And I have seen a lot of this, an improvement, a strengthening of social cohesion and cooperation. That's become exceptionally important with being threatened by this kind of common enemy that we all have, unseen enemy, that is, the coronavirus. And that's got to happen across the social fabric so that everybody gets on the same page, following the same evidence. Based policy. We've had three episodes on the value of civil dialogue, on thinking clearly, and finding common ground. And that's another big factor that I'm hoping will take hold as a result of being faced by this common threat.
Yeah, absolutely. I will add to that. I often like to point out the difference that there, you know, there's being friends, there's being civil, and then there's, you know, just being neighborly. Out of necessity, a lot of us have become much more neighborly. We're looking out for each other. We're helping each other. We still don't have to agree. We still don't have to go to the same church. We still don't have to be on the same page about everything, but we can still pick up the phone and ask, "Hey, I'm going to the market. Can I pick you up anything?"
Yeah. And we saw a lot of that happening, especially the starting point. And you and I were talking a little bit earlier before the broadcast about how it just seems like in the last week or two that things started to go south a little bit with the divisiveness and the protests and that sort of thing that are so unhealthy, in addition to the unhealthiness of a virus. I'm going to put these on the on our Facebook page, but I did want to give a few what I consider to be reliable, accurate, up-to-date information sources related to the COVID-19 pandemic. And I would start out with the CDC, Center for Disease Control. They have a very, very comprehensive set of pages that relate directly to the coronavirus. And the World Health Organization and the National Institutes of Health. Do you have any that you want to mention?
I've been mostly just paying attention to Humboldt County's COVID information. They've been releasing daily information. It's been really helpful and I thought very neighborly, if you will. And with just so much going on and, you know, trying to parse out all this information myself, I've decided to stay more local in my information because that's what is working for my mental health at the moment.
Yeah. I noticed that on their main county webpage for Humboldt, and each county is going to be different on that regards, but and that webpage is humboldtgov.org. They have direct on their homepage, that page that you go to when you go to humboldtgov.org, links right there to COVID. You don't have to search for them. They're right in your face. You can also email them at covidinfo@co.humboldt.ca.us. And I'll, again, put these on the Facebook page. And they actually have a phone number that you can get some information over the phone if you're not hooked up to the computer and the internet. And that's 707-441-5000. The one other that I will put on the Facebook page is the National Academy of Medicine. They have a really good coronavirus resource page. Time to open the phone lines. Questions relating to our current topic, critical thinking, in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. One thing I'm interested in is when you see something that you question on social media or hear something in a conversation or somebody writes to you something that you question the information. I have a little, I call it a BS meter, you know, that just sort of pegs at some information and kind of goes in the middle with some other information. And I file it away in my, ooh, that's something that I need to think more about and find out more about when I hear about it or see it. But when that happens, what is your process? What do you do? Do you dig in and research? What's your process? What's your experience of coming across information that you think is questionable? And then how do you react and respond to that? So that's one possible thing that people could talk about. But we're pretty open. We'll talk about anything that relates to critical thinking and the current pandemic resources or whatever.
Yeah, well, I think the callers came right back. It looks like we have another caller on the line.
Okay. Welcome to Thinking Clearly.
A couple of points. Julia, the religious aspect of Brigham University, you know, I have very little regard for the Christian Science religion. I think it's resulted in a lot of deaths because of their refusal to have medical treatment in a lot of cases. They've had a lot of court cases where, you know, they've lost, actually had manslaughter because they didn't get their kids treated. That being said, their paper, the Christian Science Monitor, is probably one of the best, most objective papers on the planet. I mean, really well rated. Back when Nelson Mandela was in jail, they let him read the paper because they assumed it didn't, you know, cover a lot of what they didn't want it to cover. And it was his lifeblood, he said. When he went to Boston a few months after he was released, he went straight to the Monitor paper and thanked them because that was the only way he got information. So, there, you know, you can't judge by the package. The second thing is in the craziness, you talked a lot about politicians and the politics affecting things. I'm not going to try to even pronounce the drugs, but of course we've had a drug that has been kind of pushed for whatever reason. There's all kinds of speculations by the president and his administration as solution to all the problems. And there's been a lot of skepticism. And whenever anybody says, well, you know, the science isn't quite ready for it yet, hasn't had enough trials, there's some questions about it, they're accused of throwing cold water, saying that it's not going to have any value. And then something weird happened since then, is that another drug, and I'm not, it begins with an R, and I'm not going to try to pronounce it. It looks like there's some good trials with that, but a lot of the people who are supporting the administration are skeptical about that particular drug. So it looks like we've got a red drug and a blue drug now. And, you know, whereas nobody seems to be content to let the science work out, have its time. Maybe both of them will be useful, but it's a real, I think, one of the most bizarre issues of partisanship in our time.
That's an interesting point. Politicization of science is taking off even when it comes to something like medical studies. The interesting thing about it for me is that the rate of science is typically very, very slow. Science is slow and methodical, and it's self-correcting, and it's checking and making replications of studies, and that takes a long time to accumulate the evidence that a drug is probably effective and probably safe. And it's being sped up, isn't it? Just like the vaccine, there's pressure to speed up the testing, find new ways to testing quickly. And that's an interesting process, and it's something that just may need to happen as we experience future pandemics. These bugs are not going to stop being creative, so we're gearing up, so there may be some shortcuts that we're going to be able to experiment with that will speed up the science.
That's the case. I also hope that they don't cut corners in the process that,
sure,
you know, creates a negative outcome. I mean, a lot of those procedures are there for reasons. They're not just like, you know, because they feel like doing it. They're based on experience. So I hope the pressure, you know, doesn't incorporate an abandonment of science with that, because as we know, it takes a lot of work to acquire just a little bit of knowledge about anything. And, you know, so. But on the other hand, I'd love to see this thing done in with a vaccine as soon as possible. So I'm rooting for that to happen. I hope it works out. I understand there's a British trials already with human trials. Doctors who are part of the research volunteered themselves, and you know, we'll see. They're talking about September timeline, but even my amateur mind says that that's just really optimistic. So.
I think you bring up a good point that, you know, talk about even more reason that we need critical thinking. Here we have what should really be a science, you know, should be left to science to examine, and is being highly politicized. And it's yet another layer that we as information consumers have to dig through just to get to accurate, meaningful information. And I think we have another caller.
Okay, caller, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hey, how's it going? Hello. Mikey G over here in Covelo. My grandfather was a military doctor in World War II. He did like 30,000 surgeries. But what I'm saying is that they're going to test you. So if they test you, they're going to have drones, which is a drone police thing. But really right now comes down to food and fuel. Whether you want to be part of the food company growing organic food or supporting the fuel company. So that's the point I was getting to.
Let me interrupt you for a second, because what we're interested in is not so much the details of what you believe, but how you came to this information. What process did you use to come to these claims that you're making right now? What process do you use? What's your favorite way of gathering information so that you can take that information?
I hang out with Julia Butterfly in the tree when she stood up there for 2 years. I'm an Earth First member. I got knocked out by the redwood tree.
So let me understand. It's mainly from your personal experiences with being an environmentalist or an environmental protector?
I'm a very non-radical environmentalist. Nothing.
So you've learned respect for the environment.
Yes, for the land. So you get the respect back if you give it. If you don't give the respect to the land, it will not give it back.
You'll get no argument from me on that the environment is important. There's a whole part of science that's called environmental studies, right? They do scientific research.
Face to face? I did. One race over here in Covelo, up in halfway to Trinity County. I met up with Sasquatch face to face, and I watched it hid its face and walk away from me. I was born and raised up here.
Paul, we're coming up towards the end of the hour here, and we do want to end this show on time. So thank you for calling, and I think we're going to have to wrap it up.
I sure am glad we figured out this whole COVID thing tonight.
Well, we touched on some issues, and I'm going to keep optimistic that this will bring us together as a society. So I want to thank Amanda Hughes that was in that pre-recorded interview. I want to thank Dara Lee for being a great engineer. And I want to thank you, Julia, for coming remotely and being ever present on Thinking Clearly.
Thanks, Bob, for keeping the critical thinking light burning. Thank you for keeping this going and always having a thought-provoking show with us.
And until next time, keep thinking
clearly.